Okay, so the work I'm going to talk about is joint work with Oded Goldreich from the Weizmann Institute, Shafi Goldwasser, who's my advisor at MIT, and also a faculty member both at MIT and the Weizmann Institute, and Anna Moshkowitz, who's a student, a PhD student at the Weizmann Institute. And we're going to talk about whether you can base the hardness of inverting a one-way function on NP-hardness, and I'll explain this is what I mean by that. I'm trying to give all the definitions in this talk, so some of them will be superfluous for this crowd, but just in case, I'll give all the definitions. So what's a one-way function? It's a function that's easy to compute. There's a polynomial-time algorithm given z atoms f of z, but it's hard to invert. That is, any probabilistic polynomial-time algorithm given z would fail to output an inverse z with high probability over the random choice of z. So note that the hardness here is not a worst-case hardness like we're used to in complexity, but an average-case hardness. It's hard to invert with respect to some sampleable distribution, and for the purpose of this talk, we'll concentrate on distribution f of uniform, distribution induced by choosing z at random and applying f of z. So that's what we have in mind, is something like factoring, which is not known to be one-way, but it's believed to be one-way, where the input is a pair of primes, and computing the product for a direction is easy, but it's believed to be hard to given a product of two primes to find those factors. And one-way functions are really the heart of cryptography. They're necessary for almost everything you want, for encryption, signature, commitment, you name it. So it's the most fundamental primitive in cryptography. Now, of course, you would really like to show for some function f that it is really a one-way function. Maybe you want to prove that indeed the reverse direction, inverting the function, is hard on the average. I mean, this goal seems very hard to attain. In particular, if we show that f is a one-way function, then we show for an NP problem, the problem of finding the witness, finding the inverse of a function, where z, the inverse, is a witness for the relation y equals f of z. So we show that this, if f is a one-way function, then this NP problem is not in BPP. Namely, it doesn't have any probabilistic polynomial-time algorithm. So proving that f is a one-way function implies BPP not equal NP, which is, we would like to show that, but it doesn't seem to be something you should pursue if you want to graduate. So we know already that BPP not equal NP is a necessary condition for us to have a one-way function. How about if we try some refined goal? How about if we assume this complexity separation, BPP not equal NP, and try to base a one-way function solely on this assumption? So this one-way function would be based on the minimally possible assumptions. And this is desirable because unlike one-way functions that are based on ad hoc assumptions, like factoring is hard or discrete log is hard, such a function would be based on an assumption that's of interest to a much wider community. People in algorithms, complexity. So intuitively, it seems much more robust. If so many people didn't manage to show a probabilistic, an efficient algorithm for NP-complete problems, then we believe that these classes are separated more strongly than we believe assumptions that a smaller number of people worked on. And specifically, it also means if we show a one-way function based on this assumption, then the complexity assumption is the worst-case separation. All it means that for infinitely many input size, there is an instance for an NP problem that is not solvable in the probabilistic polynomial-time algorithm. Whereas the one-way function property is an average case hardness. So it would be great if we can do something like that. And let me now, this is kind of just all intuitively, let me be formal about what I actually mean when I say basing one-way function on BPP not equal NP. Or in short, I say basing one-way function on NP hardness. To do this, I want to do what's standard for us in complexity. I want to show a reduction. I want to exhibit a function f that has the easy correction direction, sufficiently computable, and to show a reduction from some NP-complete language L, say satisfiability, to inverting the function f on the average. So just to illustrate what I mean, the reduction would be some probabilistic polynomial-time algorithm that, given an input x, it needs to decide, is x in the language, the NP-complete language L, or not. Now, this reduction is allowed to us inversion queries to some oracle that we assume it has access to. An oracle that, given y, can return an inverse of y with high probability over random z. So it inverts f on the average. And after asking many inversion oracles, the reduction will compute something and then decide if x is an L or not when it's supposed to succeed with high probability. The what? Right, so I'm talking on the average with respect to the sampleable distribution by which we generate the instances of the function. So here, for simplicity, I will think of the distribution f of uniform. That is, the distribution is f of z, where z is chosen at random as a domain. But in general, it could be any sampleable distribution. So if you're... Right, so inverting on the average means that the oracle will return the correct answer, say, for half of the y's and the false answer for the other half. But in general, half is just a parameter. We can fix it to any one over poly fraction that you're interested in. Okay, so that's what we're going to mean by basing a one function on NP hardness. And why does it really give what you want? Why does it base the hardness of inverting f on NP not equal BPP? Well, let's think for sake of contradiction that f is not hard to invert on the average. So this oracle can actually be replaced by an algorithm, probabilistic polynomial time algorithm, that inverts f on the average. Now, this reduction, which in itself is a probabilistic polynomial time algorithm, together with this algorithm we suppose that we have for inverting f, they form an algorithm that, given x, outputs 1 if and only if x is an L with high probability. So this alleged algorithm will decide the NP-complete language L with high probability. And it will give a BPP algorithm for an NP-complete language and showing that NP is contained in BPP. Or put conversely, if we think that BPP is not equal to NP, then this oracle cannot be replaced by any efficient probabilistic polynomial time algorithm. So this shows that F is hard to invert on the average. And if I pause for a second, if there are any questions, because we're going to use this definition all throughout the talk, then please stop me if there's anything that's not clear. So OX, so the reduction is supposed to work on the worst case X's, and the with high probability here is over the random coins of R, but not of the reduction, but not over the instances X. So you can think of it as reducing the worst case decision problem to an average case inversion problem. Okay, so the question that we ask today is it possible? Can we actually find a function f, a reduction r, in the language L that have these relations between them? And the reason, maybe the motivation to raise this question is that in the mid-90s, there seemed to be some positive indications in this direction. In 1996, Itai showed a one-way function that was based on the worst-case difficulty of some lattice problem, the problem of finding the shortest vector in the lattice. Of approximating the shortest vector in the lattice up to some polynomial approximation factor. Then this one-way function is based on the worst-case problem, but it's not an NP-hard problem, so it's not doing what we specified in the previous slide. However, in the subsequent year, Itai showed that the exact version of this very same problem is indeed NP-hard. And the hope was maybe this gap between the two problems can be bridged, and maybe you can show that the very same problem to which Itai based the one-way function on is itself NP-hard. And then in this case, Itai's function would be a one-way function that's based on NP-hardness. Now, this hope was shown to be false by Goldbach and Goldwasser a few years later, who showed that for much smaller ratios of approximation, the problem, the approximating the shortest vector lattice, shortest vector in the lattice, is not likely to be NP-hard. That's because they showed it's in NP in the Sequoia. But so it is this specific direction of working with I-types one-way function, and the lattice problem on which he bases its hardness does not lead to basing a function on NP hardness. Yes, so here the reduction can ask many queries to the oracle, polynomially many. So it doesn't have to be, it kind of complicates the analysis. So the size of the query, the reduction is an efficient algorithm. So the size of the queries and their numbers is determined by the size of the input x. And if you're asking about the reduction, we're going to talk about all kinds of reductions. You could think of deterministic reduction, randomized, in our case it would be randomized reductions. You could think about adaptive reductions or non-adaptive ones, where non-adaptive ones can just compute all queries to the reduction in advance, to the oracle in advance, send them all in one round and get all the answers, whereas adaptive ones have to send a query, see the answer, and then the next query depends on the answers of the oracle. So there are all kinds of reductions, and we'll discuss different types of those. Okay, so we saw one direction of trying to base a one-way function on the NP, and this direction doesn't work. And the question is, okay, what do we do now? Do we look for another NP, another decision problem, and try to build a one-way function from it? And the answer we give in this work is that it's unlikely this can work. It's unlikely that you can find a function f and an NP complete language L with a reduction between them, as discussed before. I'm saying unlikely because when I specify the results precisely, you see that there are some restrictions either on the function f or on the reduction r that we currently have on our theorems. So if you take the optimistic view, you can say that you could still look for such a reduction, but you have to direct your search at functions and reductions that avoid the theorem that we give, that fall out of the restrictions that we will specify. So this could seem pretty surprising. How can we really show such a thing when we don't have F, we don't have L, we don't have R, and we somehow want to show that such a combination cannot exist? And the idea is that we assume for contradiction that there is a reduction R from some NP complete language L to inverting some efficiently computable function F. And now we're going to somehow use this reduction R to give a short proof for L complement. What do we mean by short proof? We'll see different meanings. It could be, for example, an NP proof or interactive proof. We'll see what we mean. Now recall that L was NP complete, so a short proof to L complement means that the entire class of co-NP has short proofs, which is believed to be unlikely. For example, if the short proof would be an NP proof, this means that co-NP is contained in NP, which is not believed to be the case. So this is a very high-level structure of the proof that we'll give, and this is not new to our work. Such high-level structure appears in work of Brassad, Feigenbaum, Fortnow, Bogdanov, Trevisan, et cetera, in the upcoming slides, and the different work differ on what they actually mean by short proof. Is NP proof, interactive proof, we'll see what they mean. They differ on what types of reductions and functions they handle, deterministic reduction, randomized reductions, etc. And of course, on they differ on how they actually use the reduction R to give the short proof to L complement. Okay, so let's see what was known prior to this work. So already in 1979, Brassard asked if you can base one-way permutations, namely functions that are one-to-one and onto, on NP hardness, and he restricted his attention to deterministic reductions. And he showed that this cannot be unless co-NP is an NP. Namely, the short proof that he gave for the L complement is an NP proof in this case. Now, in the early 90s, the attention shifted from one-way functions to decision problems that are hard on the average. So the question now is the reduction from deciding a language L on the worst case to deciding the same language or another language L prime on the average case? And Bogdan Trevisan, in the work building on Feigenbaum and Fortnow, showing that decision problems that are hard on average, again, cannot be based on NP hardness, In their case, they're restricted to non-adaptive reductions, and the complexity implication, the short proof, is a non-uniform AM proof. And I'll explain the next slide. I'll give the definition of what it means. So let me highlight a few points. First, they handle decision problems instead of one-way permutations of Broussard. So in this sense, they're more general. And also, they handle randomized reductions, so they exclude a broader class of reductions. So again, they're more general than Broussard. On the other hand, they're restricted to non-adaptive reductions, namely reductions that can compute all queries to the oracle in advance, send them in one run to the oracle, and see all the answers. This is in contrast to reductions that the next query depends on all the previous answers of the oracle gave. So this seems to be a concerning limitation, both because we have some complexity results showing that adaptive reductions have greater power than non-adaptive ones, and also because the motivation, the reduction of ITA itself, was indeed an adaptive reduction. So it seems kind of limiting to exclude only non-adaptive reductions. And last, the short proof in the case, instead of NP proof, is a non-uniform AM protocol. That is a bounded protocol. Let me define this. I think I have a slide on this. So what's a non-uniform AM protocol? And we first defined an AM proof. So if you want to prove AM comes from Arthur Merlin, you think of Arthur being this wise king who's wise, but he's just human, so he's bounded in power, and he's our verifier. It's a probabilistic polynomial time machine. And Merlin, that's a prover who's all-powerful. He's a magician. He can do whatever he wants. And they communicate in a constant number of interaction rounds between them, such that if the prover is honest, then, and the statement is true, X is really in the complement language, then the prover can convince the verifier Arthur to accept. And conversely, if the statement is false, then whatever the prover does, whatever strategy it takes, the verifier will reject with high probability. So the first is the completeness of this proof, and the second is the soundness of this proof. And I just want to say that restricting the attention to a constant number of runs is very significant here, because it's known that if you take, say, polynomial number of runs, then already these proofs can prove much wider classes of languages. So there's a large distinction between talking about constant number of runs or a greater number of runs. Now, what's non-uniform AM? That's the same as the above, but now, in addition, the verifier has some shorter device string, a polynomial length device string for every input length n. So somehow, magically, it has some extra information. Okay, so that was the result of about decision problems, showing that they cannot be NP-hard via non-adaptive reductions and with the short proof being non-uniform AM. Now, Bogdanov Trevisan also asked, what about search problems, NP search problems that are hard on the average? And he showed that such problems also cannot be based on NP hardness, again, via non-adaptive reductions and with the same complexity implication. And just to give a taste of the way they do it, basically they take their proof for decision problems, they take just the theorem, they don't need the details of the proof, and they combine it with non-reductions from search problems to decision problems, reduction of Valli and Fazirani, and then the Vitrol, Goldbach, and Luby. So this result basically takes the previous results where all the hard work they do is focused and combines with generic reductions. And then they say, well, what about the one-way functions that are based on NP hardness? And they observe that if you have a one-way function based on NP hardness, then you have a search problem, the problem of finding the inverse, that's also based on NP hardness. So they conclude that one-way function, due to the previous theorems, one-way function also cannot be based on NP hardness, again, via non-adaptive reductions and with the same complexity implication. So this was the starting point of our work, and the observation that initiated this work is that one-way functions are not precisely search problems that are hard on average. They have additional structure that I'll discuss in the next slide, And our hope was that we will use this additional structure to give stronger results if we are interested in one-way functions and not in decision problems, which is our interest in being in cryptography, I guess. So let's see, what's that additional structure that one-way functions have that is not that the search problems do not possess? So let's compare search problems and one-way functions. In both cases, we have an underlying NP problem, where for NP search problem, it's by definition. For the one-way function, it's simply the problem of searching the inverse, where the witness for the relation y equal f of z is just the inverse z. And in both cases, we are interested in average case hardness. But for one-way function, they have additional property, the property that you can efficiently sample pairs of instance and witness, pairs of f of z and z. This is simply because you can sample, say in our case when talking about f, you can sample z uniformly at random from the domain and then compute by the easy forward direction of f of z, and then you have a pair f of z and z. Now, this third property has no parallel for in search problems. We don't know how to do anything like that for search problems in general. And the proof of Bogdanov-Tevrissian does not use this third property because all their technique focuses on the case of decision problems. And then they use generic reduction to get the result for one-way functions. And our hope was to take advantage of this third property to give stronger results. So what are the results we show? First, we show for a natural family of one-way functions that I'll define next, that they cannot be based on NP hardness, even via adaptive reduction, unless co-NP is in AM. So this improves on the previous results, both by handling adaptive reductions, and not just non-adaptive ones, and also by giving a uniform implication. The short proof is an AM proof instead of a non-uniform AM proof. So what is this family of one-way functions? So we say that f is size computable if given y, you can tell how many inverses y has. For example, if f is regular, that is every y has the same number of inverses, then it's trivially size computable for every y that's in the range of the function. This theorem actually works for a wider family of functions, not just size computable. It actually works for any size verifiable function, which means that we don't actually have to compute the number of inverses. There only has to be an AM proof for this size. And it doesn't actually have to be a proof of the exact size, but just a good approximation of the size. So what he shows is for every size verifiable F, it cannot be based on NP hardness unless co-NP is in AM. What about general functions that are not size verifiable? Well, there we also have an improvement over the prior work. We show that any one-way function cannot be based on NP hardness via non-adaptive reductions, so we are restricted to non-adaptive reductions like the previous works, unless co-NP is in AM. So here we improve by having a uniform implication. The short proof is an AM proof and not a non-uniform AM. And just maybe a side comment, I'm not sure I can think of any candidate one-way function that we use that is not size verifiable. So this seems to encompass many of the things that we actually intuitively think of them as one-way function. No. So it has to be one of a poly which depends on the parameters of a polynomial. So it's pretty tight approximation. And as and also, if the number of inverses is very small, up to some polynomial size, then you actually want to give the exact values. It's just when it grows, when it grows beyond some polynomial threshold, then you can start giving approximations.
What did you say about that you cannot think about one-way functions that are not size verifiable?
Yeah, so
I cannot think
about
that.
Good. I think this is the size verifiability is a pretty strong property because it means that you have an all-powerful prover that can do whatever he wants, can compute whatever he wants, and someone needs to to convince you on the number of inverses. So for example, if you think of number theoretic functions, then the prover can just give you a secret key. It can give you the fact, so if you're talking about RSA, you have n, which is a product of two primes, the prover can just give you the factoring of these primes, and then you can compute whatever you want. I doubt it. I doubt it. I don't know, but I don't see any intuitive reason why it should. I think it's more our nature to think of simpler examples, and being such referable is simpler than being something arbitrary. That's true. We don't have a lot of candidates, too. Okay, so let's continue. So this is just comparing the results of previous works and see that they have restrictions of the reduction, the function, and we improve by handling adaptive reductions and also by having the complexity implication to be uniform instead of non-uniform. Okay, so let me try to give some ideas of the proof. So first, let's give it a naive attempt. It wouldn't work, but it would give us an intuition of what we are trying to do and also of the main difficulties that we have to handle. So recall that the higher level structure of the proof would say was to say that assume we have some reduction R from n-pickles language L to inverting F on the average, and we're going to use R to devise an AM proof for the complement language, L complement. So here's one idea for an AM proof for L complement. So recall that the reduction, when given input X, outputs 1 if and only if X is in L with high probability. So how about if we just run the reduction R on the input X and reverse its output? If it says 1, we reject. If it says 0, we accept. If it says 0, we accept that X is indeed in L complement, that is, it's not in L. Now, the problem with this idea is, of course, that we cannot run the reduction because the reduction needs access to an inversion oracle, and we don't have such an oracle. The entire purpose of this reduction is to show that F is hard to invert on the average, so we cannot have an efficient algorithm that inverts it. But when we're talking in the setting of AM protocols, we have a bounded verifier, but there's also an all-powerful prover. So the all-powerful prover, of course, can invert the function. He can do everything he wants. So the idea is that let the verifier run the reduction, and every time it comes to some oracle query, it would send this query to the prover, get an inverse, and continue running the reduction. And then reverse the output of the reduction as before. Now, there's already a problem with this. So if we could do that, then because the reduction succeeds with high probability, then indeed the verifier will accept if X is an L complement and reject otherwise with high probability. What's the problem with that first attempt? Well, first problem is that it takes too many rounds, because we already said that every time the verifier sees a query of the an oracle query of the reduction, it talks to the prover and gets an inverse. The reduction can make polynomially many queries. So this incurs polynomially many communication rounds, where an AM proof is restricted to constant number of rounds. So if the reduction was non-adaptive, we can actually solve that pretty easily, because the verifier can compute all queries of the reduction in advance, send them all to the prover, get all the answers, so it's just one communication round and continue the reduction. But for adaptive reductions, just to compute the next query, the verifier must have the previous answers of the oracle, so you can't do that. But this first problem can be solved fairly easily. The idea is that instead of letting the verifier... So the reduction outputs 1 if and only if X is in L. And now the AM proof, it's a proof for the statement that X is in L complement. So you want to accept if X is in L complement. This is a statement we want to show because we want to give, our goal is to give an AM proof for the complement language. And this would show that NP is, that coin P is contained in AM, which would be a contradiction. If we do the reverse, if we give an AM proof to L instead of L complement, this will only show that NP is contained in AM, which is no contradiction, because AM is a generalization, considering the generalization of NP. It's a fact. Exactly. So it's important to work with the complement language, but you're right that technically everything could be done with the language L and not L bar. It just wouldn't give us the contradiction that we're after. Okay, so the idea is the verifier just chooses random coins for the reduction, sends those random coins to the prover. The prover now runs the reduction and sends a transcript of the run. It sends all the queries the reduction made, all the inverses it used, and the verifier now verifies that indeed the transcript is valid, and these are indeed queries of the oracle queries of the reduction. Each inverse A is indeed an inverse of the corresponding query, and that the reduction outputs zero, saying that X is not in L, and it is in L complement. Okay, so this is a naive attempt, and we'll see that actually this naive attempt fails too. Okay, let me try to explain why. So at first it might seem surprising that it doesn't work, because the verifier can check that it got a valid inverse for each query of the reduction. So why isn't it just a normal run of the reduction, which by the premise of the reduction would return the correct solution with high probability? And the reason for that is kind of subtle. It's true that the verifier can check that the prover returned a valid inverse for each query of the reduction. But the verifier cannot check which inverse the prover chose. The prover can choose, if there are more than one inverse, if there's more than one inverse, the prover can choose which inverse it returns. And somehow this turns out to cause troubles to the reduction. And I'll give an exact example in the next slide to show why this is a problem. I'd just like to point out that if the function was one-to-one and onto, if it was a permutation, then the prover doesn't have more than one option. For each query of the reduction, there's only one inverse it can return. So in this case, this naive protocol already gives an AM protocol to L complement. So this already proves that one-way permutations cannot be based on NP hardness. But when we want to extend to functions, more general functions, even functions where there are only two inverses for each query, this does not work. So to see how the prover can really fool the reduction, let me try to crystallize the differences between an oracle and a prover. So what's an oracle? The key property of an oracle to remember is that it is memoryless. You can think of it as a predetermined string where for each query Y, there is some predetermined inverse A. Well, in most cases, this inverse would be a correct inverse, and in some cases, it could be junk or don't know symbol, because the oracle is allowed to err. And the guarantee of the reduction is that for every fixed oracle, for every fixed such string, and every input X, with high probability of the random string, of the random point of the reduction, it will give the correct decision on X. Now, what about a prover? A prover, unlike an oracle, does remember the history of the queries that the reduction makes, remembers it, and at will, he may want to use it to fool the reduction or the verifier. So how can you do that? So let's try to illustrate the situation. We call it, for every fixed oracle, the reduction succeeds with high probability over its random coins. So in this table, every row represents one fixed oracle, and every column represents some random coins of the reduction. And we see that in every row, we have more check marks saying that the reduction succeeds, cross marks saying that the reduction fails. But once we fix some column, once we fix a randomness to the reduction, possibly there still is some bad oracle for this randomness, such that if the prover chooses to answer like this one bad oracle, the reduction would fail. Now, the prover, in our case, we send the randomness of the reduction to the prover. So the prover knows what random coins we are using, and he can choose this particular bad oracle that would fail the reduction. And actually, even if we didn't send the random SD reduction, even if we were in the case of non-adaptive reductions, and the verifier would just send the queries to the prover and not the randomness, still by inspecting the correlations between the different queries of the reduction, the prover can infer the randomness of the reduction and still choose to answer like this one bad oracle that fools the reduction. This one reminds that I want to stress that this problem occurs already even if there are only two possible inverses for each query of the reduction. Because when we have q queries of the reduction, two possible inverses already give 2 to the q possible oracles, which allow such a situation to occur. So all this leads us to the new goal of saying that if we want to fix this AM protocol that we gave, what we need to do is somehow eliminate the choice of the prover. We want the prover to have to answer with some specific inverse. We don't really care which inverse. All we want is that this inverse is independent of the randomness of the reduction. So which inverse should we ask the prover to use? Well, we can, for example, ask it to use the smallest inverse in the lexicographic order. And now the challenge is to somehow make sure that the prover indeed follows the instructions, that indeed it uses this fixed inverse that we ask it to give. So this is the high level of how we do it, and in the following slides I'll give the details of how it's actually done. So let's first think of a simpler case where the number of inverses for each query is polynomially small, say only 2 inverses for each query. In this case, we can ask the prover when it's to return not only the transcript of the run of the reduction, but also to return all the inverses that it had for every query of the reduction. And now the verifier can inspect those inverses and see that the inverse used in the transcript of the reduction is indeed the smallest of those inverses. There's a catch here, because how do we know that the prover really sent all the inverses? Maybe the prover just conveniently eliminated one of these inverses. How does the verifier know that indeed it got to see the entire set of inverses? So in the case of the function size computable, the verifier knows how many inverses to expect. So he can check that he got the correct number and all these are really inverses, and then he knows that he got the entire set. When f is not size computable, then there's some extra work needed, which I'll discuss later. Okay, so this was when there was very few inverses for each query. What happens when we have a super polynomial number of inverses? Now the prover cannot send all those inverses to the verifier because the verifier is a polynomially bounded machine. So it can't read a message that's longer than polynomial length. So instead we're going to use a trick where the verifier chooses some hash function, some random hash functions, that will define a random subset of the inverses of the function. And we'll ask the prover to send just those inverses that are mapped to 0 by this hash function. And if choosing the hash function correctly, this set would be small enough so that the prover can send the entire set. But now again, as before, the verifier somehow needs to verify that the prover sent all those inverses. And here, even if the function was size computable, so even if the verifier knows how many inverses y has, it does not know how many of these inverses are mapped to 0 by a random hash function. This is inherent to the randomness of the hash function. So here, proving the size requires work, even in the case that f is size computable. So basically what we did is that we started with a naive AM protocol. We showed that all we need to do is somehow eliminate the choice of the prover to a specific inverse. And now we reduce this task to the task of proving sizes of NP sets. Where by NP set, I mean a set that you can prove that you are a member of this set. Like if you're in an inverse of y, you can prove that you're in an inverse of y because you can simply compute f on the value and see that you get y. So let me diverge for a second to a discussion of tools for proving the size of NP sets. And we see that the known tools are not sufficient for our needs here and new tools that we develop in this work. So to prove the size of a set, you can prove a lower bound and an upper bound if they match, and then you know the size. So there is a known AM protocol for proving lower bounds by Goldwasser and Sipser. And this protocol for any set, any NP set S, say the set of universes of a query Y, can prove that some value little s is a lower bound on the size of S. And it proves that after some approximation factor of 1 plus epsilon. So we can definitely prove lower bounds on the sets that we have. What about upper bounds? Well, there is an AM protocol for proving upper bounds. It's a protocol suggested by Fortnow and later proved to be correct by Yalow and Hastad that for every set S proves that some value little s is an upper bound on the set on the size of S, again, up to some approximation factor. But there's a problem here, because unlike the Goldwasser-Sipser protocol that has no requirement, this protocol has some extra requirement. In order to apply this protocol, the verifier must have a secret and random element in the set S. And recall that in our setting, the set S is a set of universes for a reduction query. And the whole reason the verifier communicates with the prover is because the verifier needs some inverse of Y, some element in this set. So it doesn't have any element, let alone a secret and random element in the set. So we cannot run the Yalow-Hastad protocol, and instead we develop a new protocol, a new AM protocol for proving the upper bounds. So we actually have two protocols, but due to time constraint, I'll only talk about one protocol, which we call the confidence by comparison protocol, or CBC in short. And this protocol works in slightly different settings. Instead of having a single set for which we want to prove upper bound, we have polynomially many sets that are all drawn independently at random from some distribution. And what are we going to prove? Are we going to give the prover will give claims on sizes for each of these sets, and we'll prove that these claims are correct for most of these sets. Not for all of them, but for most of them. So it proves that little s sub I is an upper bound on the set S sub I up to, again, some approximation factor, and this will be valid for most of these sets. Now, again, like Yalow-Hastad, we have an additional requirement, but it's a different requirement, a requirement that we can actually fulfill in the settings that we are working in. The requirement here is that we know some statistics on the expected size of the sets as drawn from this distribution. And just looking ahead, I'll say that these statistics, we're going to estimate those in some pre-processing AM protocol, and to estimate those, we are going to use this sampling with witness property of the one-way function. This is where we use the extra property of the one-way function. Now, just another remark, the settings here are slightly different. We don't use this, we don't have a single set, but a sequence of sets drawn from distribution. But listen, for all the usages of the Goldwasser-Sipser and the Yalow-Hastad protocol that I managed to find, all these usages actually do have sets drawn from distribution. They don't work with a single set. So this does not seem limiting to the current applications. So I've been trying to give an intuition of how our protocol looks and why it works. So we have here all those sets, Si, and each bar represents the size of one of these sets. So what we're going to do as a first step of the protocol is run the Goldwasser-Sipser lower bound protocol to prove a lower bound. What does it give us? So the prover recall claims some value. We denote them in red, and this claims a value for each set. So can the prover claim a value that's much higher than the true value? And that is no, because the Goldwasser-Sipser protocol proves that the value the prover claims is a lower bound on the true value. So we can't overestimate it very much. What about overestimating true size by a little? Well, actually, the prover can do that, because if you recall, the Goldwasser-Sipser protocol has some approximation factor of 1 plus epsilon. So if he overestimates just by a little, then the verifier will not necessarily catch this cheating. And this actually incurs some problems in the protocol and has to be fixed with some extra step of randomization. But for simplicity and for the purpose of this presentation, I'm going to ignore that and think that the prover can only underestimate the size of the set. So the prover can give the correct size or underestimate it by a little or by a lot, but it can never overestimate the size of the set. So this was due to the first step of the protocol, where we run the Goldwasser-Sipser lower bound protocol. What's our second step? The second step, because that we know the expected value, expected size of these sets, so in the second step, we're just going to compute the average size of all the sizes claimed by the prover, and we're going to compare it to the expectation. And if there's a large gap there, then the verifier will reject, said the prover cheated. Now, this whole thing worked because of, by the law of large number, if the prover, first if the prover gives the correct values on each of these sets, then the average will be very close to the expectation, so the verifier will accept. And if the prover gives a false value that's decreased at least by one from the true value on many of these sets, then overall the average will have a noticeable gap from the expectation. Now, just as a side comment, there are some technical issues here. For example, we want to catch a prover even if it cheats only by eliminating a single element from a set. So we want to catch additive differences by one. And when you're working with Chernoff or Hofstadting bounds, usually you have multiplicative guarantees, not additive ones. But we're going to do all kinds of tricks that will ensure that these sets are of polynomial size, and then additive difference by one translates to multiplicative difference by one over a polynomial factor. So we're going to handle that. Okay, so there are all kinds of technicals, but this is the... So it will depend mostly on the number of sets that you take. Yeah. Okay, so this is the new upper bound protocol, and how do we actually use it? Oops, sorry. So we gave a naive attempt, and we showed the problems arising from it and a new tool for the upper bound protocol. Now let's concentrate on the first result about adaptive reductions and functions that are size verifiable. So again, let's think first on the simpler case of F being size computable and having polynomial number of inverses for each query, say 2. So the protocol that we sketched earlier, what it does is the verifier first chooses the random coins for the reduction, sends them to the prover. The prover runs the reduction where on each query it's supposed to use the smallest inverse, and then it returns all inverses to the verifier, and the verifier checks that indeed these are all the inverses, and that when running the reduction with the smallest inverse in each set, the reduction outputs that X is not null. In this case, it will accept. And here the completion sound is just immediate from the correctness of R, because we force the prover to behave like some fixed oracle. So what about the case where the number of inverses is super polynomial? So here, this is a set of inverses of some query Y, and it's a huge set, the prover cannot send all these inverses. Here the verifier will choose some hash function, and the elements mapped to zero will define some random subset of this large subset, and the requirement is the prover uses, in the run of the reduction, uses the smallest inverse in this blue subset. Now the prover can send all the elements in the blue set because it's a smaller set, but once again we have a problem of forcing the prover to send all those elements. How can the verifier know how many elements to expect? Even if the function is size computable, as we assume, we still don't know the size of this blue set. And the idea here is that we use the CBC protocol in some simplified settings. So we have the set of inverses sent by the prover, and this set is a subset of the true set, a set of inverses. Of inverses to the map to 0 by h, and this can be checked by the verifier, because you can check that each element in the set is an inverse of y and it's mapped to 0 by h. And the verifier knows the expected size, so now if we had many of these sets, and if the prover cheated on many of those, then with the same CBC protocol, by checking that average, comparing the average and the expectation, the verifier can reject. The question is, how are we getting to be in the settings where we have many such independent queries that are drawn at random from some distribution? we could have many queries, polynomially many queries of the reduction, but these are all correlated queries that are not drawn at random from distribution. So the idea is simply that we can run this protocol in parallel many times. Each run is with some fresh randomness for the reduction, so the queries it makes are independent of each other, and it's drawn from the same distribution. And now this sketch of proof guarantees that in most of these runs, the prover will not cheat. How do we know on which run it cheated and which it didn't? We don't really know. We're going to pick one of these runs at random and see what the reduction says on the answers of the prover on this run. And with high probability on this run, the prover didn't cheat, so we get the correct answer. Okay, just two comments. One of them, the comment we said that the verifier has to choose a hash function to send to the prover that defines this blue set of inverses. Now, this hash function depends on the number of inverses that Y has. So to choose this hash function, the verifier must know how many inverses Y has. But the verifier can only know that if the prover who runs the reduction tells him what query he's looking at. And again, if the prover has to communicate with the verifier after each query that he sees, then we'll have polynomially many communication runs, which is not what we want. So instead, the verifier will just choose the randomness for picking a random hash function and the prover will have to choose a hash function using the randomness sent by the verifier according to some pre-agreed protocol for choosing a hash function, a pre-agreed algorithm. A second comment is that, for simplicity, we talked about size-computable functions all the time. If the function is not size-computable by size, but size-verifiable, then whenever we need to know the number of pre-images, the number of inverses supply, the prover will just send this value, and in the end, the prover will prove in parallel for all queries Y coming up in the protocol that their size is correct. Okay, so I'll just give a few words on the... Oh, see, I have 5 minutes, so I guess the clock there is not accurate. So I'll give the ideas of how we extend this proof to general functions, but restricted to non-inductive reductions. So the intuitive idea is somehow we want to show that for any F, we want to show that it's size-verifiable. We want to give a protocol that can prove the number of inverses for each y. And we're not going to be able to do that. But what we are going to do is to give such a proof for all y's that matter. And by fixing the previous protocol and giving such proof, we're going to give an AA protocol for L complement in these settings. So what do we mean by all the y's that matter? Let's see with a simple observation. Note that in the protocol that I gave, we never need to know the number of inverses for y's that didn't come up in the reduction. So we only need to know to verify the size of y's that actually come up in the reduction. So this is one simplification if you want to give a size-verifiable protocol to F. Another simplification is, recall that the oracle is allowed to err on many of the inputs. It's only required to succeed in inverting F on the average case. So actually, we can define pretty large sets of the Y's on which the oracle is allowed to return wrong numbers or just say that it doesn't know the answer. One way to define such set is by distinguishing queries to light and heavy, where light queries are queries that are distributed roughly like the distribution F of Z, where Z is random. So, to put it differently, we say that Y is light if the probability that it comes up in the reduction is not much larger than the probability it comes up by choosing random Z and computing F of Z. And by the definition of light queries, there just cannot be too many heavy queries that are not light, with respect to the distribution F of U. So the oracle is allowed to return don't know on all heavy queries, and we actually only need it to return a valid inverse on the light ones. I'd just like to comment that this distinction to light and heavy appeared in the work of Bogdanov-Chevy's son with a different definition. In their case, they don't have two distributions to consider, but the idea behind the definition is follows from there. So according to this, what we actually it's sufficient to be able to force the prover to use the smallest inverse for light queries and say you don't know on the heavy ones. To do this, what we need is to verify the size of light queries as before and to be able to distinguish light from heavy queries. Why do we need this second thing? Because if we don't know when the query is light and when it's heavy, then the prover can just say on each query, I don't know the value, but it's heavy, so it's okay. So it won't give the oracle any information. So the verifier must know when the prover is allowed to say don't know and when it's not allowed to say don't know. And here again, achieving those two tasks boils down to finding the sizes of NP sets. So verifying the number of inverses, of course, this is by definition the size of an NP set. What about distinguishing light from heavy queries? So if you look at the definition, to know if a query is light, we have to compare two probabilities. And the probability that Y equals F of Z for Z, a random element in the domain, that's proportional to the number of inverses Y has. So that's proportional to the size of this set. And the probability that Y equals R of the, so Y is a query of the reduction, that's proportional to the number of random coins of the reduction that leads to this query. So to the set of coins of, that you know, coins of Y, it's the number of coins leading to this query. So in order to know if Y is light, a query, light or heavy, we need to know the sizes of these two sets and compare them. Okay, so I'll wrap up in a second. I'd like to say that the high-level structure of a protocol in this case would be composed of two phases. In the first phase, we're going to learn some properties of the function of the reduction. We're going to gather statistics about the expected number of inverses for light queries and the expected number of coins leading to each query. In the second phase of the protocol, we're going to do things similar to what we did in the case of adaptive reductions, but now we're going to verify the size only for light queries, and we're going to need to distinguish light and heavy queries. And for this, we're going to use the CBC protocol for upper bands to be designed and another protocol that I didn't have time to discuss. Let me just rush ahead to conclusions. Sorry, okay. So we improved on previous works by showing results for adaptive reductions and not just non-adaptive ones for giving a uniform implication, so our short proof is an AM proof and not a non-uniform one, and also by giving two new upper bounds protocol that could be useful in other settings other than this. I'm not 100% sure, but I think the multi-prover proof is also equivalent to p-space.
Make it short enough so it's not equivalent.
So could it be. We didn't try this direction. So all the one-way functions that we know are, that I can think of at least, are in NP intersects coNP.
Yeah, right.
So maybe you want to show separation between this NP intersects coNP, NP, or BPP. This would be maybe a better path to go if you really want to base a one-way function on complexity assumptions.